This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Modern medicine is pushing the limits of how long we can live. You've heard about stem cells, engineered organs, and overall better health care. But with all the high-tech bioengineering, are we losing sight of the person being treated? In other words, is medicine actually allowing us to live better as we face aging and dying? It's a conversation that each of us will ultimately need to have. My next guest says that what medicine can do often runs counter to what it should, and it's time to re-examine our healthcare system. Atul Gawande is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. He's the author of the new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the Ends. He joins us in our CUNY studios here in New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. And we have an excerpt of your book at our website at sciencefriday.com/beingmortal. And you can give us a call. What has your experience been confronting aging, end-of-life issues? Give us a call, 844-724-8255. This is something that we are all dealing with these days as we have an aging population. From reading your book, it doesn't appear that our healthcare system has been equipped, sensitized, pick out a word. Well, you've got all the words in the book to deal with it.
Well, we don't manage mortality very well. And I think it's been made complicated by the fact that we can do so many things incredibly well. Mm-hmm. 1950, the majority of Americans died in the home because coming to the hospital wasn't seen yet as offering you much of significant value. Mm-hmm. As we discovered 6,000 drugs, 4,000 medical and surgical procedures, all kinds of stuff we could do, it added years to people's life. And by the end of the 1990s, 83% of us died in an institution, only 17% at home. We have been great at knowing what to do when we can fix, but it's been hard for us to know either when we should stop or, more to the point, how we use our capabilities to ensure people have a life left that they still have worth living.
Did these people back in the old days when they were dying at home, were they dying better because they were at home?
Well, you know, arguably in some ways, yes, in some ways, no. We didn't offer nearly enough pain relief, mm-hmm. and we didn't have those technologies. You know, I describe my grandfather and the way he died in a rural village in India. And his aging process, you know, he lived to 110 wow. years of age. For the last 20 years, though, he needed almost 24-hour care. But in America, where he would have been in a nursing home, there he was surrounded by family. He never lacked for people. He sat at the head of the table. People still came to him with business decisions and, you know, recommendations about marriage. You know, it was the kind of old age we all want. At the same time, you know, in the final final moments and passage of time, mm-hmm. it isn't always so peaceful and great. And so we have certain capabilities to make it possible to, you know, achieve people's priorities besides just living longer, but we don't even identify that people might have some priorities besides that.
And is that the problem? We don't identify it, or we don't offer it to them?
I tackled this because I didn't feel I was doing a very good job. I'd been a surgeon for more than a decade, and then my father was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And out of interviewing lots of patients, seeing and visiting what geriatricians and palliative care doctors did, and then looking at what happened in my own family, what I realized is, in medicine and in society, we simply have not recognized that people have more priorities besides just health and survival and safety, that well-being is bigger than that for most people. The second thing I realized is that the most reliable, and discovered, you know, just there's actually evidence, the most reliable way to find out what people's priorities are is to ask. Mm-hmm. And we don't ask. We don't ask as families what people's priorities are. And as doctors, we're not asking. Less than a third of the time for terminal cancer patients do we ask them what their priorities and goals are if their health worsens.
Because I've been involved with cases with end-of-life situations. I've been around them. I've discovered a couple of things. One is that when people who are a certain age or a certain stage in life, or they're coming, they're either cancer victims or heart patients, and they've sort of said, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. I feel very comfortable with the decision I've made. Just help me get there. You don't hear a lot of those You know, what is the normal response you would get to that if you were a physician? And what's different about how we treat medicine?
Well, what I observe and even saw in myself is, you know, as a doctor, you feel like, well, I've failed. I don't have, you know, maybe can we do X, Y, or Z to extend your life? And the idea that we would be able to recognize that this was someone who had might have come peacefully to the end. Here, let me give you the example. My father came to this place, and he ended up in the hospital in his last few days. My mother had called the ambulance. His plan was not that we would call the ambulance, but my mother feared he'd had an overdose of his narcotic and took him to the hospital. There, we were very clear. He didn't want to be put on a ventilator. But with oxygen and IV fluids, he came back. Mm-hmm. He woke up, and they reversed the pain medication.
Right.
And that woke him up. Mm-hmm. And he said, what am I doing here? Number one, this is not what I wanted. And then in the hospital, so he's a surgeon.
Right.
In his own hospital where he practiced, his own colleagues and friends were not willing to give him sufficient pain medication to deal with his pain. He was in tremendous pain when you reversed the pain medication. They would not give him enough pain medication, and he finally was furious and checked himself out. We took him home. We made sure he got enough pain medication because in our minds, you know, surely survival and safety must be the first priority. How could it be that you would be willing to have, you know, in theory, less time? Now, here's the important set of studies. There is a number of trials, but the most well-done one, we looked at stage 4 lung cancer patients. On average, had just 11 months to live. They randomized them to have half receive usual oncology care, and the other half had usual oncology care plus palliative physicians who had a conversation with them about what their goals and priorities were for the end of life.
For pain, for dealing with the pain, palliative meaning.
Well, their
pain?
Priorities, and priorities might vary. Some people might say, you know what, I'm willing to live with some pain if I can be awake and alert and see my family or complete a life project or get to a wedding I'm trying to get to. Other people might say, you know what, pain, nausea, like that is my top priority. Other people might say, just keep me going no matter what. Mm-hmm. But being able to assess and say, here are my priorities, here's what I'm not willing to sacrifice. That group ended up choosing to stop chemotherapy earlier. They ended up having one-third fewer days in the hospital. They had less suffering at the end of life. They started hospice sooner. And here's the kicker. They lived 25% longer.
Really?
Yes. And so that meant that we just were making bad decisions. When you're giving that last-ditch, desperate $80,000 drug out of a hope that, well, maybe you'll have a lottery ticket that this will win you the cure. The reality is we are getting all the toxicity and none of the benefit when you use it as a last-ditch effort. And we're actually shortening people's lives and reducing the quality of their life. And that's when you have just total failure.
Mm-hmm. So how do you train doctors to be sensitive to this? I mean, you want to change things, right? I can see your father's experience really influenced you in writing the book and going forward.
Yeah, it was many experiences, but it certainly culminated in my father's.
So how do you change this?
Yeah, so I think a couple of things. One is naming the issue, and I think we've had a hard time. It's been a polarizing debate, and we've had a hard time naming what is the goal here. And the goal, and this bothers me, that the flip side of the argument is that, you know, we really need to be talking about a good death, is what some people will say. The goal is not a good death. The goal is as good a life as possible all the way to the very end. And we have, you know, it's a question of what are you going to fight for besides just more time? And the answer is going to fight for quality of life. And if you ask... there are certain skills that really good clinicians have, but I think also families can have them, for being able to have some simple conversations that we teach medical students and I think the public to be able to have. Those conversations start with just some basic questions. Asking someone who might be facing serious illness or frailty, what is your understanding of your condition, of your health? The second question is, what are your fears and worries for the future? What are the goals you have if your health worsens? What are the outcomes that you'd find unacceptable? And if you know the answers to those questions, they provide a guidepost about where you draw the red line, like you will not sacrifice this when it comes to a person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fundamentally important.
A lot of people spend their last days in nursing homes.
Yes.
I hear by the way you say that, that's not something, it's not a place, or at least the people in most of them or many of them are not equipped to handle these, the end of life that you're talking about.
Well, it's not only the end of life issues. Once you realize that the fundamental failure is that we don't ask people about their priorities, you realize we're not asking people about their priorities for quality of life well before they're terminal. You know, when people start losing enough ability to take care of themselves, I tell the story of my wife's grandmother, who was widowed in her 60s, lived independently into her 80s, very happy being on her own until she crashed the car into the house across the street, had some falls at home, had these moments of confusion, and she needed to get help. Mm-hmm. Got put into a place where they walk in the door and they tell you, don't worry about grandma, she will be safe. But safe meant that all her choices were whittled away. She couldn't wear shoes she loved because they weren't considered safe. They had heels and maybe she would fall. She wouldn't necessarily get to eat the food she wanted. You have to wake up at a certain time for the pill line. You have a right. schedule. You're an institution and you feel institutionalized.
And people, and I've discovered from my own experience, people of that age who are in that situation say, I'm not looking for safety.
Exactly.
I'm looking to be myself. If I wear shoes and I slip, that's fine. But that's me.
Well, and here's the irony. Those places are busy. They're not selling to the elderly, to the parents. They're selling to the adult children. So children, one person mm-hmm. explained to me that I interviewed for the book. She said, safety is what we want for those we love, and autonomy is what we want for ourselves. Mm. So there's this group of pioneering places that have been built around a different philosophy. Some of them are called greenhouses, for example. And instead of building all of the rooms around a nurse's station, which is the normal way nursing... Mm-hmm. Oh, nursing homes look like hospitals nowadays. Right. These ones are built around a kitchen. And you get private rooms instead of, you know, being doubled up with somebody. And in the kitchen, here's the amazing thing. You get to go to the refrigerator and get whatever you want. Mm. Now, that's incredibly controversial because suppose someone, a diabetic, goes to the refrigerator and gets a soda against the rules. It's not safe. You know, what if an Alzheimer's patient who's on a pureed diet goes in and grabs a cookie? You know, when you get written up in one of these places, and by the way, you're in a place you can get written up. Mm-hmm. I saw Alzheimer's patients who were, you know, written up for hoarding cookies against the rules. And it's like, let them have a cookie. Right. So what if they choke? Right. Some risks are ones that living is about being able to take those risks. And here's the irony, is that when you give people the freedom to make some choices, and not just take those kinds of risks, but also have people actively helping them figure out, how do I stay connected to the church I want to be in, or see my friends, or go out for a movie? Then suddenly, people actually live longer, even though in theory, the risks can be higher.
Talking with Atul Ganwandi, who is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, author of Being Mortal, Medicine, and What Matters in the End, on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. You visited a nursing home run by Bill Thomas, where he was trying to make it a lively place, just like you're talking about. But he had to disguise it, didn't he, so he could collect the money that he needed, the patients needed in a nursing home.
Yeah, so these greenhouses that I described that are built on a smaller scale, you know, he needed to have them qualify for nursing home dollars, mm-hmm. which meant that you had to meet certain requirements of what they look like and have certain kinds of meet regulations, but at the same time look nothing like a nursing home. You know, that there's individual, you could bring your own furniture. When they first would get inspected by the nursing home inspectors, though, they would look around and go, why do you have knives? And because you need them in the kitchen. Right. Say, well, but suppose someone cuts themselves. And they had to work their way through. Now, the interesting thing was he found that the regulations actually allow you to interpret them in ways that allow these choices to be mm-hmm. made. And it was a process of educating the regulators and the state to recognize that people have a desire for autonomy and choices and living in a place that's like a home. Having a room where you can lock the door if you want to.
You want to make it more like a college dormitory than a nursing home.
The amazing thing is college dormitories aren't more expensive than other places. They're just, it's really the culture of how they're designed. They're expected that people can take care of themselves and live as they wish. I describe a woman up in Reading, Mass in a place run by this amazing woman who built a, it's for low-income elderly. Mm-hmm. And she has severe dementia. She's missing 30 years. She thinks she's in her 50s. She's really in her 80s. She's in a wheelchair. She's diabetic. What does purpose in life mean for her? It isn't hard for you to see it. Her purpose in life, she loves being connected with people. She loves seeing friends, and she loves going out. And so they would arrange, okay, you want to go out? We'll go out. She loved to go out on a Friday night to TGI Fridays. Mm. And they'd arrange for her to be able to go out with friends. And, what would she order when she went out? She'd have a margarita. they'd triple up on the Depends.
What a surprise. I want a margarita.
Yeah. Exactly. And she was living, Bill Thomas calls it the three plagues of living in a kind of, in an institution. The three plagues are boredom, helplessness, and loneliness. And being in places that allow for spontaneity, allow for you to, learn and try new things, even if you happen to be in a wheelchair, even if you happen to have some confusion or other difficulties. That is what's starting to be built, but it mm-hmm. is only the vanguard right now.
All right, we're going to come back and talk lots more with Atul Gawande about being mortal medicine and what matters in the end. And when we come back after the break, I want to get into what happens if you can't afford these things and, public institutions. Our number 844-724-8255. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how to improve end-of-life care. My guest is Atul Gawande. He is a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and author of the new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. Atul, when we went to the break, you were talking about a low-income housing, public housing project. And that was going to be my question about finances. That seemed to be very successful even with people on the low income end. So you shouldn't be... You should be expecting you might be able to find stuff like that even if you're low-income public housing.
So the question is, can we make places that serve people's priorities besides just being safe, pulsing, mm-hmm. Organisms? And the answer is that it is no more expensive, and these places are demonstrating it. The greenhouses, the low-income housing for the elderly that I described there. Mm-hmm. We talk about innovation happening like the mobile technology. Some of the greatest innovation going on right now is around how you make affordable housing that can work this way. It is still a minority of what's available out there. And certainly there's a very high end of this that is extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. And probably the most successful is if you're able to arrange for help in your own home, because you make your own rules in your own home. But not everybody right. is able to afford that. So the ability is a gradation. I think we have the capacity to make more of the kind of housing that we want available, either services in the home or beyond. But we haven't woke. We're just now waking up to the fact, as the baby boomers age, they're not going to be put up. They're not going to put up with being put into, incarceration.
So is Medicare or health insurance going to be able to be flexible enough to allow you to be in these other places getting care?
The experiments that are being done right now show that you can take the same Medicaid dollars, and it's Medicaid that people fall onto. It's at the state level that they fall onto when they don't have enough money to cover mm-hmm. their housing. And the same Medicaid dollars can be flexed over to these kinds of institutions and not cost a penny more. Robert Wood Johnson Foundation has been running experiments with housing like this in every state in the country now, mm. where they are deliberately designed to still fit within the same dollars that we're spending now.
Let's go to the phones. Let's see, get a call or two. Emily from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Emily. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay, so my question is, I work in healthcare, and I deal a lot with end-of-life, last-ditch efforts on treatments and such. So I guess, you know, I deal with that on a daily basis. My question would be what your thoughts are on the right to death with dignity debate that's going on and the laws that are in place in a few of the states.
Yeah. So I have complicated feelings about this. On the one hand, I think that that when people face unbearable suffering that is unavoidable, that we would be heartless not to be willing to offer options that let them have a prescription that could take their suffering away, and yes, end their life if there's no other option except to suffer endlessly. On the other hand, the goal is not a good death. So although I'm, you know, I think the experience in Washington, Oregon, where you can get these prescriptions, is that less than 1% of the population ends up seeking these prescriptions. And when they get the prescriptions, only half end up using them. It's a kind of relief just to know the option is there, I think, for some people. But there's another cautionary tale, which is the Netherlands, which was the first country to use these kinds of prescriptions, was one of the last countries in Europe to actually develop a hospice and palliative care set of networks and institutions, that it was easier to provide assisted death than assisting with living as good a life as possible all the way to the end. And I think that the capacity we have for being able to make it so that people have less suffering. This debate is going on in India right now, by the way, where laws are being proposed about whether people could have assisted suicide at the end. In India, what I've seen and observed is that that people don't provide pain medication sufficiently, hardly any narcotic medication, and so people are in terrible pain. And so, yes, would they choose assisted suicide? Of course.
Yeah.
You know, given that choice. But let's give them pain medication. It starts with that. And so, you know, it would be heartless to do nothing, and yet it will bother me, and it is a mistake if we make that the priority or the sole direction that we go.
Let's go to Cincinnati. Welcome, Margaret, to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I was just wondering how you can get medical institutions to to work with you when you have an older person that you're taking care of, and they've made very specific ideas of how they want their end of life to be, and then you have to take them to the hospital, and the hospital refuses to let them go home when they've got care in place for home.
Yeah, this is part of why I'm writing this book. You know, if I just wrote my scientific articles, we may not get anywhere. But if you also are trying to speak at, you know, describe, put into the mirror what our own experiences are in the profession and for the public to see, you know, we do this. We bring people in. We say, well, we can't give you pain medication because it might not be safe. And then you can't go home to have it in your control because, you know, you haven't arranged for it to be safely done there. I've seen those kinds of cases. Mm-hmm. I think with my father, there were moments like that as well. When we went to see the oncologist after he had had surgery that successfully bought him more time without quadriplegia with this brain tumor he had that was in his spinal cord as well, he then went to radiation therapy, and the radiation therapy, you know, we gambled and it made him worse. So then the choice was chemotherapy. We got 8 different options. We're going through all the options with the oncologist, and what he cared about, my dad cared about, was that he wanted to know whether he could still be taking the chemotherapy, trying to go for more time, but preserve what was important to him, which is being awake at least some of the day, being able to interact and be social, and still be involved with certain projects he cared about. And we couldn't get the oncologist to recognize that these were the issues we needed her to recognize. And we ultimately had to just say, I get that all of this menu of 8 different options are out there, but are there any that are going to be what's the most likely one to allow him to still be able to do the things he wants to do? And we ultimately, you know, had to push and say, in the end, none of these options sound like they're going to provide the care we need. And so he chose not to do any of the chemotherapy at all.
Mm. So it seems like it's a very subjective opinion by which doctor you happen to be working with, someone who's more compassionate, someone who's been better trained, who understands what you're doing, maybe has his own or her experience at home and knows what you're going through. Is there any way to smooth this out so that regulations or guidelines are written by states, federal guidelines, hospitals themselves, that lets you listen to the patient more?
Yeah, it's not as simple as, like, you know, follow this rule book, right?
Right.
But there's an evolution in the relationship between the patient and the doctor. Half a century ago, it was doctor knows best. The doctor told you what to do, hardly ever went over the options, might not even tell you the diagnosis because they didn't want to worry your pretty little head about
it, right?
We rebelled against that in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. And the way I was trained in the 90s was what I call doctor informative. Here's option A, option B, option C. Here are the pros, the cons, the risks, the benefits. What do you want? And people often would come back and say, geez, I don't know. What would you do, doctor? What would you recommend? And we're supposed to say, well,
it's
you know,
your mother, right?
Yeah, you know, this isn't my decision. This is yours, and I don't know you. And you know, what people want is a counselor, and the counselor is someone who asks those questions I described, develops the skills. They take some skill and practice to be able to learn how to ask effectively and listen for and deal with the emotion of people answering questions like, you know, what are your fears and what are your goals, and working your way through those questions. If you know those answers, you can guide, you can provide a recommendation. And sometimes the recommendation might be, you know, we're gonna try option C, or maybe none of these at all.
Do you think your book is making a difference? Have you noticed a difference?
Well, I'll only say this. I think this has been a polarizing debate for the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
And this time, people across the spectrum are not going on the attack and polarizing. I think it's partly because when we talked about the idea that people needed this conversation, the fear was that it was a conversation about what you're going to take away at the end of life. But the job of medicine, and I think of families, is to figure out what to fight for. And if it's not fighting for more time, no matter what, it's fighting for people's quality of life and priorities, no matter what. And the irony is, just fighting for people to have a good day today and don't worry about tomorrow doesn't turn out to shorten people's lives. It often extends them. It certainly makes for better lives, whether, you know, at the stage there that we have to enter into getting help in facilities or coming all the way to the end.
Atul Gawande is surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, author of the new book, Being Mortal, Medicine and What Matters in the End. You can read an excerpt of this book at our website at sciencefriday.com, Being Mortal. It is an excellent book. Anybody who is thinking about this should well pick up a copy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Atul, for being with us.